Welcome. I'm John Kiriakou, and this is The Deep State. Here on The Deep State, we go deep into stories that the mainstream media simply doesn't want you to know. The Deep State imprisoned me once upon a time. Well, now we're going after The Deep State. I want to bring on now Jackson Hinkle. Jackson is an American political commentator. He has one of the most engaged accounts on X in the entire world, and he's the host of the daily show Legitimate Targets on YouTube. I want to turn to an issue that is generally not really talked about in the media, Jackson, and that is Kashmir. I served in Pakistan for a good stretch of time, and Kashmir is always front and center in the mind of every Pakistani. Less so in the mind of every Indian, but the Indians essentially control Kashmir. And it's funny. Excuse me. My sympathies really are with the Pakistanis on this, right? There was this deal from the 1940s that was negotiated by the great powers and the nascent United Nations, and there was going to be a referendum, and everybody was going to have a say and a vote, and the Indians just grabbed everything and have said, you know, tough luck ever since. So even as recently as 2002, the U.S. government, in the form of the CIA, has gone to both sides and said, you know, please just walk away from this. It'll be better for everybody, for both India and Pakistan, better for the world, better for the region. Just walk away from it. Neither side would walk away. So with that said, I was asked a question on an Indian news program not too long ago about Kashmir. And I told them what I just told you. They cut that out of the final show, which is why I no longer do Indian and Pakistani media. And they asked me the follow-up question, which they ran the answer to. The follow-up question was, if there were a war, who would win? And I said, well, both sides are nuclear powers, so nobody would win. If neither side used nuclear weapons, it just stands to reason. You know, India has five times the population that Pakistan has, and just by sheer force of population, the Indians would win. Immediately, the death threats started again from Pakistan. And then Imran Khan's political party director sent me a letter. How he got my home address, I have no idea. He sent me a letter demanding that I apologize to the Pakistani people and to Imran Khan. It's like, what are you, nuts? All I said was, India has five times the number of people. And if there were to be a conventional conflict, the Indians would probably win. Okay, so ignoring that, looking just at Kashmir, it looks to be intractable. Do you think it's intractable? And if not, where do you think the solution lies?
Well, first of all, I'll say that I'm sure that's exactly what Imran Khan wants most in the world right now, as he's in prison, is an apology from John Kiriakou. I'm sure he wants nothing more than that. That's all that's on his mind. But look, I mean, I have no sympathies whatsoever for India. I'll just be very open and honest about that. I always thought that the local politics in Kerala were pretty interesting as a communist. But apparently, with all the money in the world BJP has, they can just buy elections. They can, over time, right? They can will their way into existence in any part of India, any government. And also, I'll add that I also don't want to do any Indian or Pakistani media. I don't know if you remember Chris Halali, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
very well.
He used to do your show back in the day.
Oh, yeah,
another
good guy.
Greek Orthodox.
That's right. Good
guy,
and
a
terrific analyst. Terrific analyst.
He's terrific. But he told me the other day, he went on Pakistani TV, and he just said something like negative about Trump. And they're like, oh, we have to cut the interview. Like, no more. So you can't say anything bad about Trump either, apparently.
Oh,
but,
my God.
I'll also be honest in saying that I don't really know too much about that conflict. And my sympathies lie with Pakistan on it. I know a lot of Pakistanis. They always want to, well, it's one of the topics that was discussed a lot during the Pakistan-India skirmish for obvious reasons. But I don't know. Nothing is intractable. Everything can be won. These are the laws of history. And, well, I also agree that in a normal setting, I guess India would probably win just by sheer manpower. But then you also have to ask the question, like, how many of those people in India are really, like, willing to go fight and die? How many of them are, you know, really at fighting capacity? I don't know these answers, but interesting to think about nonetheless, I guess.
Yeah, I have to agree. I have to agree. On a broader scale, I wanted to ask your opinion on issues related to NATO, and not just NATO vis-a-vis Ukraine-Russia. I was in Cyprus for the last 2 weeks. I just got back day before yesterday. And everywhere I went, people asked me this same hypothetical question. You know, they fear and they hate the Turks in Cyprus, and in Greece for that matter. And over the last 10 years or so, they've grown very, very close to the Israelis, very close to the Israelis, which is funny because it's exactly the opposite of the way it used to be. It used to be that the Turks were close to the Israelis and the Greeks and the Cypriots were close to the Arabs. When Erdogan decided to switch that that policy, everything changed. Now the Greeks and the Cypriots are close to the Israelis. So the question everybody had was, the Israeli defense minister said recently that he is predicting that Israel's next big fight is against Turkey. Well, the Turkish military is enormous, first of all, and it's very well equipped. It's a gigantic NATO military. If the Israelis were to attack attack Turkey, the Turks could invoke Article 5 of the NATO Charter, meaning an attack on one is an attack on all. That would then force the United States to enter a war against Israel. I can't imagine any world where that would ever happen, but that's what the NATO Charter says has to happen. And in Cyprus, everybody wanted to know, would the U.S. jump in on the side of the Turks or on the side of the Israelis? My answer to them was, that would be the end of NATO. If the Turks were attacked by the Israelis, nobody would come to Turkey's aid. And because nobody would come to Turkey's aid, NATO would essentially cease to exist. This is why the Cypriot president just 2 or 3 weeks ago said that the European Union needs its own military that doesn't include the United States and doesn't include Turkey. And by extension, doesn't include the UK or Canada either. What do you think of all that? Are people looking too much into this?
No, I don't think so. This was something that I was really interested in after the fall of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. Uh-huh. It seemed as though things were really heating up in the first few months. And you had the Israelis calling for recognition of Kurdistan. You had initial movements taking place by the Israelis into Syria. And, of course, the Turkish government was making their warnings and their threats as well. But I think it's very possible. I think it's likely. I don't know if this is really an accurate way of putting it, but it could be the culmination of those in Israel who have this greater Israel vision and those in Turkey that have a neo-Ottoman vision. I don't know, but Turkey, as you mentioned, it's not just that they're a NATO. I think other than the U.S., right, they're like the strongest military in NATO, or one of the strongest. They also have a very robust domestic manufacturing of military assets, especially drones. And this week they just unveiled, I think it was the second iteration of one of their intercontinental ballistic missiles. I don't think it's too high tech compared to what the Russians have, but it's pretty interesting. And Israel would be absolutely crushed. And I agree with you. No one would come to Turkey's defense, but how could they possibly preserve NATO, if that's the question? Maybe if they all coalesce and blame Turkey as the sole party responsible for the start of the war and say, look, this is your own adventure. You guys got to fend for yourself. I don't know, but maybe they could say something like that.
You just raised something that's important that I actually had forgotten about. Excuse me. That is the changing nature of warfare. And we saw it, or we have seen it in the Russia-Ukraine conflict. We're seeing it in the Gulf right now, the Persian Gulf. It seems to me that the United States is way behind the times. We're seeing that wars are essentially being prosecuted with drones now, right? Not with human beings, but with drones. And it's a finite situation where million-dollar rockets are being used to defend against $10,000 drones, right? You can't just fight a fight like that forever. You're going to run out of rockets. You're going to run out of money. You're going to run out of wherewithal. And in the current case, where the United States is providing just about all of its military hardware to the Israelis, what's left to defend the Kuwaitis, the Bahrainis, the Saudis, the Qataris, the Omanis, the Emiratis? There's nothing left. And another thing, too, I'd love to get your thoughts on this. The United States loves to, you know, pound its chest and say, we're sending aircraft carrier strike forces to this part of the world or to that part of the world. Nobody cares anymore. It's not the aircraft carrier strike force that's going to win the war. An aircraft carrier cannot defend itself, for example, against a hypersonic missile. It can't. It also can't defend itself indefinitely against a swarm of suicide drones. Suicide drones that the Iranians produce, the Turks produce, the Israelis produce, the Russians produce. Everybody produces these. They're cheap and they're reliable. And so the U.S. has these, you know, multi-billion dollar state-of-the-art crafts that are just too big and too lumbering and too slow and too out of date. So have we seen a change in the nature of warfare, do you think? And if so, how does the U.S. protect itself?
Of course, it goes without saying, but it's a matter of whether or not countries are adapting to it.
Yeah.
And, you know, you look at even the drones that America loves to utilize, at least over the past several years, or the Israelis, these big, these big hulkish Hermes 900s.
That's
or
right.
The MQ-9, the different Reaper drones. These are tools of the past. They're so expensive. They're so expensive, and they produce very high-quality images, and they can be very high undetected. But, I mean, the Iraqi militias, Kataib Hezbollah, al-Shahada brigades, they're flying these little FPV drones all across Victoria Base in Iraq, and they're flying it all across, and then later in the night, they send some missiles in. So it's in Russia, in the Russia-Ukraine conflict, everyone knows you can't have more than 3, 4, maybe 5 men together at any time, at any point on the front, right? It'd be insane to do that because you know you're about to get a drone, fiber optic drone, launch in your direction, and then there goes the group. In Lebanon, we see all of these Israeli troops in large numbers stacked together. You see convoys of vehicles still traveling with one another. And then you just see the FPV drone go in, or you see it drop a grenade, and there goes, you know, 6, 7 guys, maybe a few more injured. It's insane that we're still witnessing this. And then to think that, you know, bring it back full circle, the conversation about taking Karg Island or even Chabahar Port or Keshem Island, it's like, have we not learned from Russia and Ukraine that these amphibious landings with large amounts of men, it doesn't work anymore? They're talking about 2,000 in these MEUs, 2,000 infantry in each one of these MEUs. They've sent 2. They have 10,000 in the 82nd Airborne they sent over there. I mean, it's just going to be a slaughterhouse. And I don't want to see that, but that's what's going to happen.
I don't want to see that either. One of the things that that American policymakers just have failed to appreciate, I guess, is the fact that Iran is the size of Western Europe, It's 3.8 times the size of Iraq, and we see what happened to U.S. forces in Iraq. It has a forbidding topography, high, impossibly high mountains. You're right, 15,000 troops on some low-lying island in the Persian Gulf, it's not going to change the course of the war. It's just simply not. When I was still at the CIA, the Pentagon used to talk about liberating the greater and lesser Tunb Islands. They were long claimed by Sharjah, one of the emirates in the United Arab Emirates. And in the middle 1990s, the Iranians moved troops onto the Tunbs. The Iranians had long claimed the Tunbs as well. And they've had the Tunbs ever since. So the conventional wisdom is, well, we're gonna send troops to the Tunbs and we're gonna liberate the Tunbs. Okay, number one, no human beings live there. They're just empty. You're going to liberate them. Okay, great. And then what? Then what are you going to do? Has it changed anything at all? Of course not. Nothing. So if you're on the Tunbs and you're looking at a country that's the size of Western Europe, then what do you do? What comes next?
Well, I don't think any of this is going to go well. I think this is just going to get worse and worse. And I think Netanyahu wants Americans to die because that's going to latch us deeper and deeper into this war. It shouldn't, but that, you know, if you put some sort of sacrifice forward, the I guess conventional wisdom is finish the job, but it's a job that can't be finished. But John, I have a question for you, about this in Iran, because one thing that I've heard you say, and I think you're 100% correct, you know, just observing all of this as a layman, you know, you talked about how Iranian intelligence is known for being, you know, one of the most, you know, infiltrated or bought off, whatever it is, however they do it, right?
Terrible, yes.
How do you think it is now? Because we see the development of this, you know, decentralized mosaic defense system they have. We see the same approach with their propaganda, the media, all of their different, you know, embassy accounts and everything. It's very powerful. Mm-hmm. Do you think that they still have the same exact problems that they have had in the past regarding their intelligence? Or do you think that most of these assassinations we see are maybe just like a few guys there that are following certain VIP individual? How do you think it works nowadays?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. So I think the answer is several fold. Number one, the Iranian intelligence service has long been infiltrated, especially by the Israelis. The Israelis have worked on this for decades, and they've been very successful. Number two, the Iranians have a problem with Afghan refugees. Refugees get literally nothing in Iran. No food, no water, no shelter, no medical care, no nothing. So if you're the Mossad and you go in and you offer somebody $50 a month or $100 a month just to stand on a street corner and tell you when the general leaves his apartment every day and what route he takes, that's money well spent. And then third, we learned in the last few weeks that the Israelis were able to successfully hack in to the Tehran traffic camera system so they could just sit at their computers in Jerusalem and watch when the generals and the nuclear scientists were passing through whichever intersection. And it made targeting quite simple. So I think it's going to take years for the Iranians to rebuild any semblance of independent intelligence. I just don't think that that they're in a good position right now.
One thing I was so surprised by, and what they call the Ramadan War, the most recent iteration of the war, is in the 12-day war, we saw so many of these internal drone attacks, so much so to the point where they had to put their air defense systems underground, hide them, and just like accept that there was going to be some damage, right? Because they didn't want to lose those AD systems.
That's right.
We've seen none of that. You brought up the Afghans. They deported 2 million, some crazy amount of them.
It's supposed to be 2 million.
The traffic light thing, did they provide proof of that? And If not, do you believe that?
Oh, I believe it. You know, if you're not thinking it through, let's say you're a traffic official, a high-level traffic official somewhere. If you're not really thinking it through, you wouldn't think that there's any need to encrypt data like that, for example. Who cares what the traffic is like? It's out in the open. It's out in public. Well, the Israelis care about something like that. They're going to be using it for targeting purposes. And I think that's what happened. The Jerusalem Post has been very, very good about breaking these kinds of stories. They've broken these sorts of stories from the very beginning of the conflict, or even going back to the 12-day war. And one thing about the Israelis, and this is relatively new, they didn't used to be this way, they almost can't help themselves to brag about their victories. When you're applying for employment in an intelligence service, one of the very first questions they ask you when you're a brand new applicant is, are you comfortable working in a position where your successes will never be celebrated? And of course, the answer is yes. Yes, yes, I don't need any recognition. I don't need any awards. I don't need anything. Just, you know, let me have the job. Well, it's like the Israelis now want to gloat. And so every time they do something like this that's significant and that's successful, they leak it to the Israeli media. And the Israeli media dutifully, you know, publish the article. For example, I'll give you another example, and this is kind of the most egregious one. The Hezbollah pager operation. I'll tell you something funny. There was a... I don't want to point any fingers, but there was an Eastern European news outlet that asked me that day if I would come on their show and talk about it. And I said, absolutely. They said, what did you think of the operation? I said, it's a war crime, but it's an act of genius. I said, can you imagine the moving parts that are involved in an operation like this? Moving parts that go back for years. You've got to buy the manufacturer. You have to control the supply chain. You have to control the middleman that was in, like, Taiwan or South Korea or something, and then control the next supply chain all the way to Hezbollah. And then you have to intercept it at some point and pack it all full of explosives, all the while making sure that it continues to work to send and receive pages. And they said, yeah, but it was a crime. I said, yeah, sure, it was a crime. Well, can't you talk about how big of a crime it was? And I said, sure, I can talk about how big a crime it was, but it was operationally, it was an act of genius. In the end, they were like, thanks, we don't think we need your commentary this time. Well, you know, let's call a spade here. These guys don't care one whit about international law. They care about winning. And winning means killing the enemy. And so they just do whatever they want to do. But we know that whole story because the Mossad leaked it to the Jerusalem Post, and they gave us the details because they were so proud of themselves.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, you know, it seems like normally these sorts of situations wouldn't be reported if they're truthful, because maybe you want to replicate certain
that's right.
operations or achievements. I will say the Lebanon thing, I mean, obviously, you said the first thing you said, war crime. I do wonder how successful of an operation it was, because
right
when I was there, I was only there for like a week or something in Lebanon, and I was primarily in Beirut. I went to the south one day, but I could, you know, there was more than 10 people I met in that period of time. Who came up to me and were just like, you know, very passionate and showing me like their little kids and stuff that had their like faces and hands blown off from the pager attack. I'm like, you know, I understand what you're saying. A successful operation is a successful operation, and things need to be recognized, right? Because if you can't recognize, I guess, success, then you're doomed to fall victim to it again. I guess we could look at it like that. But I do wonder how successful that was, given maybe how many of the pagers were in Lebanon, how many of them actually hit a target.
Right.
Probably it was a long period of time in between where the pagers were actually delivered and then blown up. I don't know, but these are things I wondered after going there and seeing that.
Well, you raise a good point. In the beginning, it looked like it was entirely successful. It had the word that was being bandied about was it had decapitated Hezbollah. And remember, in the immediate aftermath, just the days after the pager attack, the Israelis also bombed Beirut, southern Beirut, the suburbs. They killed something like the top three or top four leaders of Hezbollah. And I remember commentators saying that Hezbollah essentially had ceased to exist, at least for the time being. It was going to take 6 to 12 months for them to try to reconstitute. And that wasn't true. They reconstituted almost immediately. Otherwise, the Israelis wouldn't have had to continue bombing southern Beirut. And another thing about the Israelis, and I know I'm going to get more death threats for saying this, but I'm going to say it because it's true. If the Israelis want to kill one person, one single person, let's say he's a Hezbollah leader or some military official or whatever, and they know that he's in an apartment, they will blow up the entire city block and kill 1,000 people if they can feel certain that they got this one leader. That is a war crime. You can't do that. But the Israelis do it all the time and nobody bats an eye. And I think that the fact that they're still doing that in Beirut points to the fact that the Patriot attack was not as successful as they led us to believe. It was not. And Hezbollah was not decapitated.
Yeah. I mean, even the Iranians, when I'm having a brain fart. He was the chairman of the Supreme National Security Council.
Right.
Until they assassinated him, negotiating team.
Yes.
As well. But it's like they took out, again, he had gone to, I think it was a Quds Day protest not too long after the war started. And all of the presidents, the ministers were all there. And I get showing strong, you know, patriotism, strong show of force. You're not fearful. But then clearly some way or another, they tracked him back to his sister's apartment. And then they blew up the whole apartment block. It's
yeah,
like,
they did.
At war, we should be a little bit more careful.
Thank you very much for being with us today. That was our guest, Jackson Hinkle. And thank you for watching. This is The Deep State. And remember, keep asking the questions that the government wants you to ignore. I'm John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.